this will be my 44th year as a bhikkhu, or Buddhist monk, fully ordained. I ordained as a seminary in 1966, and then 1967 I took the higher ordination as a bhikkhu, and then that opportunity to go and train, stay with Ajahn Chah. I spent the next 10 years living mostly in northeast Thailand and practicing, training myself to live under the discipline, the conventions of the Dhamma Vinaya. So the Dhamma is the truth, ultimate truth and reality itself, or this word. I've more and more inclined to see it translated as reality. And then the Vinaya is a kind of discipline. It gives us boundaries for behavior, agreements on speech and action, and systems of etiquette and so forth that we agree to when we become monks, which allows us to live together without too many conflicts. So this is like a reflection on the use of convention. It does have its purpose and its necessity of agreements on behavior. Otherwise, if we're just each one doing what they feel like, then it's impossible to live with very many people, because we have no agreements on behavior. So in the Buddha left this Vinaya discipline as a convention to be used for, not for just blind conformity or identity, but as a expedient means to limit our behavior, our choices, our options in life, to have more time to simplify our life and have more time to really observe, be the observer, the knower of the way it is. So let's contemplate when we're doing this meditation. I kept saying the way it is, as is, the way it is. And this is merely a use of language which isn't defining or describing or judging. It's merely a way of thinking or speaking to pay attention, because whatever you're feeling right now, physically, mentally, emotionally, psychically, either high, low, good, bad, healthy, sickly, or whatever, it is the way it is. So that's a kind of, a truism, undisputable truism. But it can be never really acknowledged in any conscious way, because so much of our conditioning is about trying to make things better, trying to get something we don't have, or get rid of things we have that we don't like. And that can be like physical sensation, pain, fever, sickness, discomfort, as well as like hunger or thirst or heat or cold. It can be around emotional feelings in the present, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, extreme or whatever their quality might be. We tend to merely react to them, trying to hold on to the good ones and get rid of the bad ones, the ones we don't like. And so this realm that we're living in is to be examined and investigated. What is being a human being, for example? I mean, we all think we all assume we're human beings. But have you ever really contemplated what it is to be a sensitive human being on planet Earth at this very moment? We can hear, we can read Darwin and various views about evolution and whatnot, human history, development, from the Neanderthal to the Homo sapien and so forth, and that's all very interesting. But that's not the way it is at this time. We're we're experiencing life from this moment, this position, within the limitation that we have in our own human form. And in the human form itself is a species that has the ability to reflect on its own existence. And so this is what the Buddha really means. And we use the word Buddha, it's our ability to reflect on existence, on the reality of now. We're not just helpless victims of conditioning, like we tend to think we are. We tend to think we're, you know, we get the load of conditioning from the day we're born. We're told what's right and wrong, good and bad, reward and punishment, according to our parents, our culture, whatever is a form of conditioning that we receive after we're born. So then we tend to identify ourselves always with these conditioned rhythms that we're experiencing. We identify with the body as, this is my body, I look like this, with the, whether it's beautiful or not, whether it's male or female, whatever color it might be, whether it's tall or short, fat or thin, it's all becomes mine, you know. So this then is judged according to values of maybe what we would like, you know, the perfect human form or the ideal female form, ideal male form, is given to us by our cultural background. And we also get this sense of our self-worth in relationship to parental experience, our brothers and sisters, friends, enemies, associates throughout our life. We form these identities, conditioned identities. And of course, this is all done, this is part of the conditioning process. And because of the conditioning process becomes so dominant in our consciousness, we tend to forget our true nature and live in this world of conditioning. And some of it we feel a sense of despair or hopelessness because we haven't always received the very best of the conditions. Speaking for myself. And of course then we can think we're, you know, we should have, you know, if we had all the right conditions, all the best, then we wouldn't be suffering. So we tend to see suffering or our own dissatisfaction, unhappiness, discontentment always through the fact that we need to get something, we're missing something. We blame parents, we blame societies, religions, governments, partners, whatever. There's always somebody you can blame for your own unhappiness. And it's not that's wrong, you know, and because people can be rather mean and cruel and obstructive to us in our lives, is not to deny that. But the real suffering that we can actually deal with and free ourselves from is our own delusions around it. And that's what mindfulness allows us to do. This word, mindfulness, has become a kind of acceptable word in the modern psychological vocabulary. I suppose it's the same here in the States as in England, but the psychotherapists talk about mindfulness a lot these days. And they didn't always do that. And of course this is a word that we have this ancient language we use, this Theravada Buddhist tradition, is a kind of preserved within the language called Pali, which is an Indian language related to Sanskrit. there are various views about whether it was the actual language the Buddha spoke or whatever, but this isn't really important, you know, to try to figure all that out. But unless you're doing a PhD thesis in Buddhism. But if you're just here to awaken to reality and free yourself from delusion, then this Pali language does have its use, because it isn't. It's a kind of classic language, a dead language, like Latin, Greek. It kind of has these kind of psychological terms the Buddha used. And because the Buddha did use, when he gave his basic teachings, his very first sermon is about the nature of the mind, the causes of suffering and the end of suffering. So this is because suffering or discontentment, unhappiness, dissatisfaction is common to all of us, to every human being. Whether you're someone who has all the advantages in life, all the best conditions, or someone that has hardly any advantages whatsoever. So those are the two extremes. Most of us, have certain advantages, disadvantages accordingly. The conditioned realm is like this. It's impossible to find perfection or permanent happiness within the conditioned realm, because the conditioned realm is beyond our control. It's in this inexorable changing program from beginning to end, birth to death. And therefore, when we only observe, when we only identify, cling to, and our reality is always filtered through the distortions of the conditioning of the mind, then we miss our true nature. And that's reality itself, or Dhamma. We can't see the Dhamma. We see always these distortions that we have, that we project in through habit, through our karma. Through the force of habit, we project and experience life through these distortions of conditioning. And we can't see through them, we just tend to be controlled by them. Until we begin to develop and recognize the value and appreciate the ability we have to be awake and aware, awareness, mindfulness. It's very simple, very natural. It's not something, so high or so sublime or so refined that you can't, only very special kinds of human beings could possibly do it. And I mean, we'd all be dead if we were totally heedless, like it's a matter of survival. Because in times of necessity, physical danger, we all, automatically shift into mindfulness, just for self-preservation. But in a modern society, like here in Seattle, where everything is so, we take so much for granted. Our life isn't dealing with just the edge of survival, with survival of the fittest, but we can live our lives in a very neurotic state and create endless problems in our minds. When we're living in very secure houses with guard dogs and burglar alarms and good police force, good government and all the rest, there's still the fear, of being harmed or taken advantage of or destroyed. And of course it's rampant throughout the world. Fear is a kind of primal emotion that's part of the mammalian or animal inheritance that we have. So fear is, that this is a fear realm that we're experiencing, this sense realm, the human realm, the animal realm, planet Earth, the solar system, the sun and moon. I mean, these are all kind of magnificent phenomena in their own way. But they're also subject to change, and they're beyond our control, and we don't understand them. And we tend to see them always in wanting to, you know, either distract ourselves from any fears of the future by kind of living in worlds of distraction or sensory indulgence or ways we develop to deal with life, where we seek happiness and try to avoid the unpleasant aspects of human existence. So trying to paint a kind of picture for you, or suggestions, a way of looking at being human, is like this. We all have to experience consciousness within a limitation of this human body. Like, we're all stuck with a human body for the lifespan of it. And so we can only sit where we are at this moment. You can't sit up here with me at the same moment. Well, I can't sit with you. You know, I can't. There's only room for one body in one place. And we have this limitation of form, physical human forms that we have. They're sensitive forms. So we have to experience this continuous, unrelenting impingement of sensitivity from birth to death. So from the time you're born, you know, a baby's born, it usually comes out crying. As it goes out into the cold world after the nice comfortable womb, and experiences separation from the mother as they cut the umbilical cord, and then its survival mechanisms begin to work, and they learn how to let mother know what it needs through various instinctual mechanisms. Kind of universal intelligence operates through a newborn baby. But and then from that birth to the actual death moment of our human bodies is this experience of sensitivity. Now, sensitivity is, you know, it can be pleasant or unpleasant. It can be, you know, inspiring or depressing, whether it's the physical, mental, whether it's through sight or sound, smell, taste, touch. We can inspire ourselves with altruistic ideas, with inspired teachings. We can become depressed by thinking only negative thoughts. You know, we have this polarized, sensitive, changing realm that we have to live in and experience in this way through the human body, through the senses, through the mind. And then the Buddha pointed the way to deal with this situation, and not to try to ignore it or reject it or identify with it, but to understand it. So the Buddhist practice, like Vipassana meditation, the emphasis on four foundations of mindfulness or Four Noble Truths, these are all expedient means, ways of reflecting on the reality of our own individual experience at the present time. They're not like teachings about Buddhism as such that you have to accept. They're merely expedient teachings, ways of looking, ways of examining experience in the present, as you yourself are individually experiencing it. Now, one thing we all share in common at this moment is consciousness. Consciousness is unitive. It's not individual. This is just a suggestion. Just try to contemplate this. Not exactly whether I'm right or wrong according to modern physics or psychology, but they, in terms of Buddha Dhamma or Buddhist teaching, then consciousness is not any different. It's pure. It's expansive. It's here and now, and we're experiencing it right now. Pure unadulterated universal consciousness. And then because of that, because of our conditioning, we identify with like the bodies we have, and we make them personal, and we judge them accordingly, you know, and then we have our own memories, individual memories, our maybe inherited tendencies from our parents, our DNA, our karma, or whatever way, what words you want to describe, all the separative different conditions that an individual experiences, that which are all different from one person to the next. But pointing to this, the unitive consciousness, and then how we divide that through our attachments to conditioning. So we project into consciousness the conditions, we operate through karma, or the way, you know, the conditions that what we've done in the past, what we believe, what we grasp, then we get that kind of result in the present. And so we can experience a sense of loneliness because we are alone on the conditioned level. You can never unite on the conditions. You can, you know, kind of agree to believe or to hold up certain conditions that make us feel we can live together and agree on many things, but at the end of the day, the conditions change, situations change, we age, we have to experience life in its various pleasant, painful experiences. But what is common to us all at this very moment, which has no difference, no separation because of the forms or the conditions we're experiencing the present, is consciousness. That's very interesting now at the time in the amount of interest there is in consciousness, because we're all conscious. And it's like, you know, it's like space, isn't it? Once I point out space, you know, you can start observing space. But if, you know, it's here and now, it's everywhere, it's all around you, within you, and it goes on to infinity. Where does space end, you know, in terms of our ability to see? You know, we're limited by maybe the walls of this room, or when we're outside, we can only see so far. But the perception of space is unlimited, is unbounded, has this sense of infinity. And consciousness is the same way. It's so here and now, so real, that we don't notice it until it's pointed out. And I remember, you know, when I started meditation, I'd learned so much about Buddhism through reading about it. So I'd read about Zen Buddhism and about Theravada, read the Majjhima Nikaya and various other suttas, but still, you know, I would interpret all the Buddhist terms from a very Western conditioned attitude. You know, so you get a certain cultural take on life from the cultural background or social background that you're born into. Then, with that, of course, trying to interpret Buddhist teachings from basically a cultural conditioning that was very much based on Christianity. Because I'm from a very, my family, we were all brought up Episcopalians. We used to come to St. Mark's Cathedral. Which is very ironic to me. Here I am again. I mean, this isn't what my parents were expecting me, having it. But the fact, you know, religious conditioning, social, cultural attitudes vary. You know, your identities of your position in society, racial identities, ethnic identities, gender identities, religious ones, sexual identities, they're all conditioned into, and we project them into consciousness. You know, so we actually become these identities, and those identities are not really what we are. We just believe in them, or maybe we resent them, or they endlessly give us problems, fears, doubts, worries, and challenges, because they are limited and they are illusory. They're not reality itself. So this is for reflection, not for belief. So when I'm talking like this, I'm not asking you to believe me, but just to see what I say, how it affects you. You know, how do you react to what I'm saying? And thus you can actually know. Like bringing up the subject of consciousness, I really like this because it is so much in the mind of Western psychologists, Western science at this time. What is consciousness all about? And I remember in my early life as a monk trying to find definitions of consciousness in Pali dictionary, or what this psychologist or psychiatrist or scientist, how they defined consciousness. And I remember one time sitting in my kuti meditation hut thinking, well, I wonder what the Pali dictionary says, how they define consciousness. So I started looking for a Pali dictionary, and suddenly it dawned on me, I'm experiencing consciousness. Why do I need Pali dictionary to tell me? Which was a kind of insight into how much emphasis I put into learning about things rather than understanding the immediacy of the reality of this moment. Like, to understand space, you don't have to take physics. You can just observe it. It's here and now. Look, you can see space between these people. There's space everywhere. Space between my fingers. wherever there is, the space is the most important thing in this room, isn't it? Imagine if there wasn't any space in this room, we couldn't sit here. And yet, you know, we might look at the other things as more important, because space doesn't really register. You know, we look at the walls, the people, the objects, and then we form various opinions, whether we like it or don't like it. But space is not about liking or disliking, is it? It's just spacious. It has no sense of beauty or ugliness, because space allows both to exist. You know, in visual space, it doesn't have any preferences. It allows the ugly to exist in it as well as the beautiful. So just observing, like space and consciousness, these are, in Theravada Buddhism, of course, they call the six elements. The earth, fire, water, and air is about the conditioned realm, about the nature of the body or the material world, the liquid, the air, and the heat element. This is what this planet is about, earth, fire, water, and air. Space is, and then space and consciousness. Now, consciousness, the English word, is ability to know. It's not just a kind of stupid state. You know, when you're mindful, then you begin to open to a universal consciousness that we've forgotten. It's with us all the time, but it's always being distorted through the momentum of our habits, our feelings, our reactions in the present moment. So we're kind of helpless victims of our habits, it seems. And many of us, you know, have become interested or, you know, feel inclined to practice meditation of some sort because there's something in us, isn't there, that feels something, there is a lack, something missing in our lives, no matter how wealthy or secure we might be in the material world or in our relationships, it's still not enough. You know, it's still something, we still have this sense of lack is a part of the human experience. And that very lack is, of course, what brings us to practice meditation or to religious practices of any sort. We can have various views about religion, but what are religions for, in generally speaking, not only Buddhism but the other one, is that they're pointing at ultimate reality. You know, they're conventional forms that have their own angles, their own positions on pointing at ultimate reality, which is here and now, is, you know, the ultimate, which is real. It's not about some kind of abstract reality in outer space. It's not a kind of mind-twisting abstraction that we have to go through trying to imagine, because you can't imagine. You can't imagine or define ultimate reality, but you can know it. You can discern it. And that's what mindfulness is about. It is the escape hatch from the what the Buddhists call samsara, from the vortex of changing conditioned phenomena. The only way out of that cycle, that vortex of change, is through mindfulness. So there is, you know, like in the Pali scriptures, there's teachings, one of my favorite ones, which at Amaravati, I've asked the community there to memorize for the past 2 years. I think they're getting bored with me. But you don't have to live with me all the time. And I'm retiring. But this teaching, I always found the, you know, something in me really related to this. This is in the Udana and I think several other scriptures. But it's about, there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. Now that's a statement, that's a kind of fact statement, isn't it? It's not, I think there's something, you know, probably there is something that you call the unborn. Not like that. The Buddha was saying, there is, you know, so you have this atti, bhikkhave, ajatang, apuntang, akatang, asankatang, which means there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. So what is that thing? I mean, try to imagine. Try to form some kind of vision or icon of that unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. It's impossible. I've tried for years. All it does is stop, you know, because you have the, you know, your thinking mind has to stop because it can't deal with it. And because there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there is escape. You know, there is escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. So this is good news. You know, you're not asked to believe in something you can't even imagine. But I mean, it's a statement, but then you can't believe it. You don't, you just, I believe in it maybe, but you don't know what it is. So then, there is, because there is the unborn, there is escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. So this gives the relationship of the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned to the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. Now these bodies are born. their forms, they're created, their conditions, the body, human body, the senses we have, eyes, ears, the ability to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, to sing, to feel, emotions, psychic experiences, phenomena in all its varieties, from the most refined to the most coarse. This is the born that created the form, the condition. So that's what we, what most people regard as reality, is the born that created the form, the condition. That's what people call the real world. It's me, my feelings, and the reality that everybody agrees to in a particular society. So then, you know, that's how we tend to see ourselves or the world we live in. It's very conditioned, very limited, and very unsatisfying. And so then we hope, you know, what happens when we die, then we speculate about if you're good, you're rewarded, you go to heaven, you're bad, go to hell, or you're reincarnated, or you're reborn, or maybe, you know, if you're really a nihilist, you just, it's oblivion. Once you're dead, there's nothing left. But the fact remains at this very moment, we're sitting here, we're conscious, forms, breathing, feeling, and death. Nobody's dying here, I hope. At least wait a while. So this is like death. What does that word do to you? You know, it's something we don't know. Because physically you haven't died yet. And so we tend to project what people tell us, what happens when you die. And then people have various experiences or various attitudes, very religious attitudes about death, afterlife, then death, what happens. But for me, just speaking for myself, at this moment, sitting here, what happens when this body dies? I don't know, because it hasn't died yet. So I'll wait and find out. But in terms of learning and understanding life and death, this is our ability to observe the way things are within the limitation of the forms we're in and our own karmic predicaments. So we all have our own individual idiosyncrasies or problems or personal oddities or whatever, you know, our own take on life, our own kind of attitudes or experiences that vary from one person to the next. And then, of course, society passes judgment. Sometimes we consider, you know, this is normal, this is abnormal, this is right, this is wrong. But basically, you know, we can only experience what we're experiencing. Whether it's normal or abnormal, it's what we might label it according to society's value. But what we can know at this moment, that whatever we're experiencing, is that it is changing. It's impermanent. Every emotion, every sensory experience, every feeling, when you really observe it, when you're aware of it, then you notice that it has no essence or substance to it. It's this changingness, what they call anicca or impermanence. So this is what mindfulness allows us to get, to have this perspective on the condition realm, on phenomena, within the limitation of our experience, within the limitation of this human form. We can recognize and understand ultimate reality, and that's wonderful in this human, within this human form. You know, so this is like awakening to Dhamma, awakening to reality, is what we mean by the Buddha. The Buddha represents, the word Buddha itself means awakened consciousness. So you can make Buddha images. You can make them look like a human figure. Because within us, we all have this Buddha ability. We can be aware, and that's what means we can awaken to ultimate reality, awaken to Dhamma. Within the changing conditions that we have to live with, such as the aging process of the body or the emotional problems, tendencies, memories that we have, whatever they might be. So it is a kind of a wonderful teaching, because it's very clear in the way the Buddha developed it. It has a kind of clarity that encourages investigation. And so many of us who have this kind of skeptical nature, like being brought up as an Episcopalian, I couldn't really, when I started thinking about it, I couldn't really believe it. And so, because it's a skeptical mind. I said, God, do I? I said, I believe in God in the creed. You have to say the creed. I believe in God. I don't know what that is. And so therefore, and I've been saying it, from when I was little, you learn these things by heart. I was an altar boy saying, I believe in God the Father Almighty, and so forth. And I could say these things just like, everyone else could, but I never really reflected on them. And then when you get, especially in your teenage, early teens, you start questioning life more seriously. What do we mean by that? What's the meaning? And of course, this is a beginning of skepticism, of doubt. And then, of course, some people find belief quite easy to do. It's different individuals have different ability. My mother had no problem with believing. But she gave birth to me in a Catholic hospital, who seems to be a skeptic. I don't know what she did to deserve that. Because she was a very good Christian, she wasn't a stupid Christian or a blind one, but her ability to believe was firm and stable. It gave her great strength throughout her life. I couldn't do that. So when I encountered Buddhism, about 21 when I first really became aware of the teaching. I thought, this is something I can actually do, because the whole point is like this investigation, what I'm trying to do this evening, present, a way of looking at life, not from a position of belief or doctrine or from being a Buddhist, but from awakened attention, just being the observer. So that you begin to recognize this within your in consciousness itself, this moment, the ability that you have as a human individual to realize ultimate reality, deathlessness. We call it the Amata Dhamma, or the deathless reality. Now, pointing to this word deathless reality, the Dhamma is deathless reality. What is deathless? And you can't imagine that either. We have some maybe immortal gods like Zeus or Venus or something like that, but they have forms and they have qualities, and they're even more, they call in the Greeks they call them immortals. They're not really immortal. So immortal is beyond imagination. But we can recognize immortality. And that therefore that's through mindfulness we begin to escape the mortality that we tend to identify with. So ignorance, in this case, the Buddhist use of the word ignorance is the Pali word avijja. Avijja means not understanding Dhamma, not recognizing ultimate reality. So when there's ignorance, then we operate from our conditioning. You know, so whatever we experience in life is always through through our attachment, through fears, through anger, through greed, through habit, through worry, anxiety, that tend to permeate human consciousness. We fill it full of worry, anxiety, fear, hopes for the best. We have experienced jealousy, envy. We experience all kinds of desires, lust, sexual desire, and greed for things. We see things, beautiful material objects, brand new cars and computers, and they create this desire in us to get the latest model, the most beautiful form. Or sound, smell, taste, touch. The sensual world is about pleasure and pain, about what is beautiful, what is ugly. So much of the sensory experience is neither one nor the other. It's just like this. It's neither absolutely fantastic or absolutely horrible. It's like this. So much of our life is just in, you know, getting up in the morning, putting on your clothes, eating your breakfast, getting ready to go to the office, getting your children ready to go to school, just ordinary things that we have to deal with in daily life that are not extreme, just ordinary daily life experiences. And yet there's this longing always for extremity, for excitement, for adventures, romance, for you know, any kind of excitement. Why do people go to horror movies or fireworks or anything like this? Because they're exciting. War is exciting, isn't it? Wars are always exciting. Go to a war film. You know, I personally find war films exciting. And so this is, you know, it's the way it is. Or pornography, isn't it? It's very exciting to the mind. So sex and violence, and these are extreme forms of excitement that we tend to seek in some way or another. Because so much of our life is neither particularly interesting, exciting, romantic, adventurous. It's just like this. Getting up in the morning, going to bed at night, cooking dinner, eating, swallowing food, defecating. It's not romantic or adventurous. And so we, you know, just looking at my own life, you know, in a monastic life, you live a life that tends to where your options for distraction are limited. So you know, living in the forest monasteries in Thailand, you know, it was, so much of it was so utterly boring. You know, because you're day to day, you do the same thing, and you know, you're just, it's very routine. You spend a lot of time alone with yourself, and that can really get boring. And so you want friends or, you know, something to do, something exciting to do, something to occupy yourself. So we become restless, distracted. But also we can reflect on it. And this is what Ajahn Chah was encouraging me to do, to observe. He wasn't trying to make monastic life exciting, interesting, romantic, adventurous. It was just, you know, but it also, the encouragement to awaken to the mind itself, to the feelings one has in the present moment. Now this, of course, I could do even before I could really understand what he was talking about, because the first year was you know, like we had no common language to, you know, I didn't understand his language and he didn't understand mine. So people asked me, how could I learn anything, or how could he teach me if we didn't have common language? Because we give so much importance to understanding through language, through concept. And Ajahn Chah, when asked this question, he'd always say, Dhamma language. Then people would say, what's that? What language is that? This gave him an opportunity to expound, you know, awakening here and now, you know. So it wasn't like trying to convert me into a Buddhist monk or into a Theravadin Buddhist monk or to institutionalize me by reward and punishment, by awakening me to look and observe, to be the observer rather than the owner of the condition. The Thai language has its own kind of succinct expression for this, which don't have the same power they have in English, but they do have, you know, it's a language where you say things in very succinct, very clear ways. You get the point. And so one of them is to watch your mind. And so the common word I kept hearing, you know, Ajahn Chah's advice when he was giving Dhamma talks to people, he'd say, do jit, which in translates as watch or observe your mental states. Observe yourself. And so then the tendency was, for say, my habit tendency was to observe myself from a position of the ego, like observing myself, I become very critical. You know, observing myself, I could see, you know, I saw all kinds of things I didn't like about what I consider myself. And then I could see that basically I was conditioned, culturally and socially conditioned, to be self-critical, to give so much emphasis on what's wrong, or the flaw, or the weakness, the unpleasant side of my own experience by criticizing, by saying, oh, that's bad, you know, to think like that is bad, or to feel like this is not right. It's you shouldn't, if you're a Buddhist monk, you shouldn't feel like that. It's wrong. And that's how I tended to observe myself from the ego level. The ego operates in that way. It's always criticizing, you know, saying what's right and what's wrong and what you should or shouldn't feel or experience. But Lumpo Cha wasn't pointing to the ego, he was pointing beyond the ego to being he used the word Bhutto, or a kind of mantra form of the word Buddha, which is to know what you're feeling, to be the observer, the knower of feeling is like this. Whether it's a good feeling, a bad feeling, a right feeling, a wrong feeling, whether it's feeling you should have or shouldn't have, it is feeling, and it is impermanent. And therefore, more and more you begin to detach from it, and not say it, not claim it, not identify, not be taken over by your feelings or your judgments, your critical mind. Now the thinking process also recognizes the limitation of thought, is that it is dualistic. It can only take you so far to analyze and judge and criticize. Like the thinking ability is a critical function that we have. It's for comparing. It's for, you know, making judgments about conditioned phenomena. This is right, this is beautiful, this is wrong, this is ugly, this is good, bad, heaven, hell, all the rest, you know, the whole, when you start thinking, you always have, you see, whatever quality it might be, it always has its opposite. And so recognize that the thinking process has to be, you know, we have to get beyond thinking and somehow transcend just the thinking ability and not try to think our way to nirvana or liberation, because you can't do it. It doesn't work. So letting go of thought, this was a big challenge, because I was so conditioned to think. I was obsessed with thinking. I was so convinced I wanted to know everything on that level of judgment, of criticism, of concept, of right and wrong. So, you know, I would, you know, say what's right and what's wrong. When you're also training as a Buddhist monk, you're learning a whole pattern of behavior that is very different than what I developed living here in the States. And of course, what, you know, what is allowed and what isn't allowed and so forth, much more clearly defined in so many small ways and detailed ways. What is allowed and what isn't? What's right, what's wrong? And then the conditioned way identity with these monastic rules would tend to pass judgment. You know, it'd be like, a good monk does this and thinks like this and acts like this. Bad monk does this, thinks like this, and that's bad. He shouldn't. You want to be a good monk, don't want to be a bad monk. And then you see yourself, you know, as sometimes you feel you're not a very good monk. Not because you've done anything wrong, but so much of it is mental. Because, you know, a good monk, ideally a good monk, is filled with loving kindness and compassion. At least my ideal monk is the epitome of compassion, like the Dalai Lama. You know, that's good monk. I'm sure he's never had a negative thought in his mind. He's ideal. And then I look at myself. Some of my thoughts are not good at all. And emotional reactions. And so then it's easy to take it personally, to judge it in a personal way. But Ajahn Chah wouldn't allow that. You see, it is what it is. You know, whether it's angry, selfish, greedy, lustful, or altruistic, or high-minded, or a superlative of the best or the worst, conditioned phenomena is impermanent. So we had this continuous reflection about impermanence. And that was this emphasis on anicca impermanence, which those of you who practice vipassana are probably much aware of the they use the word anicca a lot in vipassana, as it tends to be used in the Western world. So through this kind of observing, after a while, what's happened to me is that you do have moments of insight, that the power of one's emotional habits and tendencies tend to overwhelm. So you might, you know, people have asked me about on retreats, where they 10-day retreats, or they go on retreats for a month, 2 months, or whatever, where they live under very controlled environments, then they have very strong insights, peaceful, tranquil feelings and bliss, which they can't have in their ordinary lives. So then they, you know, they think that to really be mindful you have to be a kind of a permanent meditation retreat. which is impossible. You know, you can't do that. You can't live life like that. So that those are, you know, those are kind of special conditions that are set up to help, you know, special environment. That's where it's important to see their limitation. When you don't have a lot of conflicting impingement, when you're, you know, alone a lot, or you can't just switch on the television or talk on your cell phone or go to your computer, where you're just with yourself and nobody to talk to for days on end. You know, you eventually, once you kind of accept that and stop resisting and settle into it, it's like sensory deprivation. That's an experience of tranquility, where you begin to maybe understand yourself more clearly, you know, because you're not in this continuous kind of agitated state that you probably are in when you're busy with your life, family life, working life. So, but also, to think that one has to live in a sensory deprivation tank or on a mountaintop all alone, and then the Buddha made this very clear, that's not the way, that's not, monastic life doesn't, isn't binding us to hermetic escapes, but towards involvement in society. So he evolved a monastic form that's totally dependent on the lay community. And so you find yourself suddenly, you know, you can't go off and say, goodbye, society, I want nothing more to do with you. I want to just be by myself sitting next to a waterfall writing haiku poems. That's what I used to wish I could do. You have to, you know, go out, like in Thailand, go out on arms round in the morning, and there's all continuous kind of activities one is involved in. But the emphasis on mindfulness is then on ordinary mindfulness, not on kind of a controlled situation, was Ajahn Chah's way of teaching. Living within the monastic form, not for personal benefit, but for observing the personal, the way one's emotions react, to restraint, to more defined boundaries towards limitation, towards conformity, towards a kind of sangha life in general, where your own personal wishes and desires are not foremost in your mind. You have to sacrifice your own sense of what I want to do and how I want to practice. You have to give that up towards conforming and working in a group. A sangha group. So sangha itself means a group, it's not an individual. So over the years then, practicing in this way, I've been 10 years in Thailand, and then I was sent off to England in 1977, where I've been living this will be the 34th year there. And then the application of this to life as I have to live it. You know, so living in the Thai forest tradition in northeast Thailand is one way. And going out of that particular culture environment to a European country and living with it, we had to live in London for 2 years, living in a big city like that. You know, mindfulness was still the way out of suffering. You know, it wasn't that, you know, if I started thinking I want to go back to the forest, I began to observe that. You know, I could see, you know, my own maybe complaining mind in regards to living in a big city. And, you know, living, adapting to a different society, a society that is not Buddhist. How to live within the looking like this, shaven head, funny looking robes in the city of London. Because it's very different than the reactions in London than you get in Bangkok. But anyway, whatever reactions, you know, people have, the attention is inward. You're looking at your own reactions to, you know, experience as you're experiencing it in the present moment. So developing that and that confidence, you begin to really trust this awareness more and more. It is ultimate reality, is real. It's a fact. It's not an abstract ideal. It's not just a kind of hope for the future. Then when I die, I'll go to some place called the unconditioned. Not like that. It's about awakening here and now. And this, of course, this is the kind of benefit of the human birth, because this is available to us. We're not just helplessly stuck with our forms, our human karma, our mammalian tendencies, our fears and desires. You know, we have a way to transcend and to see them in perspective. Because this unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned is mindfulness itself. It's real, it's self-sustaining, because the idea of me sustaining mindfulness drops away. It's no longer about me, Ajahn Sumedho, practicing meditation in order to become liberated. That falls away. That's a form, another condition. But you're letting go of that conditioning to totally trust in the reality of here and now, which it's not something I create. It's not a subtle, refined state of concentration that's destroyed by any disruption. It allows everything to be what it is. So applying this to just your daily life, you begin to work with the experiences that you have to have as a human individual, with the aging process of the body, with the praise you get, with the blame, with the disappointments, the despair, the depressions, the fears, desires, tendencies, identities that we individually have. We learn from them all, because we're all seeing them. We are seeing them all from this pure awareness level, in which, you know, the differences, the changing conditions are no longer how we experience our lives. It's not our refuge anymore. We still have to bear with the aging process and the problems of age, the stiffening of the joints, and the loss of energy, which I'm experiencing a lot these days. And then you have to, you know, the life itself presents us with individual challenges. Loss of loved ones. Having seen, you know, in the past 20 years, my parents, the Lumbar child teachers in Thailand have died. Separation from the love, things like this are part of human experience. But we're seeing it, we're learning from it, rather than just feeling disappointed or frightened or worried about the future. This gives you a whole way to appreciate your life as you have to live it, you know, from birth to death. So like in next week I'll be 76 years old. So to me that's an old age, and to most of you I'm sure it is. But so, and then this idea of retiring. Do monks retire? Or do they just fade away? And so this is, I don't know yet, I'll find out. But this retirement is, you know, I've been so involved with being abbot of monasteries since 1975, actually. And now Ajahn Amaro has accepted my invitation to take on the duties in Amaravati, so this relieves me from those kind of duties, like committee meetings and all the rest. So my intention is to go back to Thailand and live there. I always enjoy living in Thailand and see what happens while I'm living there till the death of this body. But just to encourage you in your interest in this subject, and to affirm this is something worth doing. It's not just trying to convince yourself or believe or becoming a Buddhist, anything like that. It's about awakening. What is awakeness? Even though we feel we're awake, we tend to not be awake. We're caught in the momentum of our fears and desires without realizing what's happening. We just kind of help this sense of helplessness as we're caught up in our emotional world and in the judgments we pass on it, about whether we're normal, abnormal, right or wrong. But as we break through these illusions, then we realize deathless reality, in which then the fear of death is no longer a problem. Because then you begin to recognize that the death of the body is it's the death of the body, that's all it is. And it's supposed to do that. Doing what it should do. And then before the death of one's body, there is the opportunities to investigate in terms of obviously the ongoing changing conditions in your mind. There's always this birth and death going on inside you. It's just observing, no longer seeing death as just physical death, but the ending of a condition. So your relationship to the conditions are knowing rather than reacting, identifying, controlling, manipulating them. So I'll stop here at this time, and if there are any questions, anyone would like to ask questions? Yes? Feel a great sense of relief. Because, even like you observe how words do affect your consciousness. Like being abbot of a monastery, is meaning you're in charge of it and you're responsible for it. And there's all these kind of words tend to be part of that identity and responsibility. So, even though I haven't really retired yet, I will go back tomorrow to Amaravati and then enter the what they call the Vasa retreat there for the 3 months, and then I'll retire after that. And go back to Thailand, but that's all for the future. Right now I'm here in Seattle at St. Mark's Cathedral. But I observe like this sense of when Ajahn Amaro accepted my invitation, it was kind of, it felt this sense of relief, like I wasn't going to be stuck in this position until I was dead. And then we've also, like Westerners, we have to learn how to deal with these things. because in the Thai system, it's a different cultural attitude they have about it, which is part of their cultural, their conventions and so forth. So for us, it's, you know, being habit always brings up, like, observe in your own mind, what, like, this sense of responsibility. Now, I was brought up in this kind of background where you should be responsible. To be called irresponsible was, like, really, it's a real insult. To say you're being irresponsible is a way to really intimidate me. Okay. Ajahn Sumedho, you're irresponsible. And then you should be responsible. I'm also a preceptor. I ordain monks and nuns, so then I'm also responsible for ordaining or teaching. I'm the teacher. I'm responsible for teaching. So this word responsible, I'm the spiritual teacher, whatever, for our group in England. So that's another one to, you know, these kind of positions that one